Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Damning climate change report warns of unprecedented devastation in our cities. Victory for Save Latin Village after 15 years of campaigning by a dedicated community. Central London unable to lift footfall as return to office push lacks enthusiastic uptake. Greenwich Royal Observatory seeks architect for historic upgrade. And programme announced for the 2021 Open House London Festival. My name is Zoe Cave, I am Head of Projects at Open City, and I will be bringing you a roundup of this week's top London architecture news. My special guest this week is Phineas Harper. Finn is an architecture critic and works at Open City, the perfect person to tell us all about the 2021 Open House Festival. Welcome to the show, Finn.
Good morning, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
Our first story this week grabbed headlines across the globe. The BBC, Guardian, Times, Standard and The Independent are just some of the publications to cover this week's shocking IPCC report, which offers a stark warning for the future of life on Earth. Human activity has changed the climate in unprecedented and irreversible ways, Monday's report warns. The study, which draws on more than 14,000 scientific papers, warns of increasingly extreme heat waves, droughts and flooding, as well as the likelihood of reaching the milestone 1.5 degrees of global heating within just over a decade. It is being described as a, quote, code red for humanity by UN Chief Antonio Guterres. Drastic action is needed on a global scale to avoid catastrophic levels of global heating, which could, the report says, wipe out entire countries due to sea level rise. Every inhabited corner of the planet will be impacted by the effects of extreme weather, sea level rise and spread of disease, and cities such as London will be particularly affected due to the urban heat island effect. With increasing density of tall buildings in the London boroughs, more heat will be absorbed and stored and less natural ventilation will be able to take place. Cities with limited parks and green space will be more at risk from flash flooding, heat waves and decreasing air quality. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said the report shows the next decade is going to be pivotal in securing the future of our planet. The paper was approved by representatives of 192 countries who will now have to work to drastically reduce their carbon emissions in the run-up to the COP26 discussions, which will be held in Glasgow this November. So Finn, this report makes for a sobering read and paints a damning picture of the planet's future. Specifically, what does this mean for London?
It's gloomy reading indeed, isn't it? The IPCC, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Like, you couldn't get a more senior group of climate scientists. This has become a familiar story, but in a way, I think it's good that we're having this conversation. You know, if you're someone like me who kind of grew up thinking about climate change and concerned about global heating, what was bizarre was, like, no one was talking about it in the media. It was always this sort of like fringe hippie concern, whereas now it is like there isn't a bigger news story. Everybody's talking about it. Politicians are making these enormous declarations. I am, you know, seriously worried about whether that's enough, but I do think we should remember that even having this conversation at all is like light years ahead of where we were a few years ago. and is an extraordinary testament to all the many activists and many campaigners and journalists who have kind of taken this seriously as the warnings have got more severe. In London, I think there's sort of two things we need to be thinking about. And the most important of those is, what do we do to radically reduce our carbon emissions? In the built environment sector, that's an enormous issue. There isn't anything more important than that issue, but also across all other sectors as well. And then the second thing we need to think about is, how do we adapt the city to the 1.09 degrees of global heating that we've already experienced? Over the last couple of weeks, there's been sort of extraordinary amounts of rain in London, flooding. We saw tube stations pretty much underwater due to flooding in the last couple of weeks. We saw Whips Cross Hospital and Newham Hospital. I think Whips Cross was without power and had to evacuate patients. And then Newham had to close its A&E and was asking patients to go to other accident and emergency centres, both of those because they were flooded. Just adapting to the climate change that London is already experiencing is a hugely important challenge. Not very far away in Europe, we've seen heat waves, extraordinary heat waves, 150 Greek islands on fire. And that those two things, that kind of extreme downpours and extreme heat waves, are both phenomena that are caused by climate change and are going to become increasingly common as global temperatures rise. And there are things we can do to kind of massively cut our carbon emissions, but there's also things we need to be doing to adapt to that extreme weather as it becomes more common.
In 2018, the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, declared a climate emergency, and local authorities across the capital have done so too. What actions should policymakers in London be taking in order to ensure we responsibly reduce CO2 emissions in the city and mitigate the impacts of global heating for the London population?
In terms of reducing emissions, a lot of that is about energy. It's about reducing our energy needs, so we're not drawing so much on power stations, coal-fired power stations or any power stations. But a lot of it's also about direct emissions. It's about things like burning petrol to power cars. And unfortunately, what we need to be doing is sort of the exact opposite of what some local authorities are doing. So, we saw a few months ago, local authority Kensington and Chelsea put in a cycle lane and then took it out again just a few weeks later, because ultimately they caved in to the pressure of motorists who didn't like having a cycle lane. We need to stand up to that kind of lobbying. We need to say enough is enough. This is an emergency, and we can no longer afford to kind of take this as an optional thing that's up for debate. Like, the debate is over. The age of the petrol powered motor car is also over, and it's time to shift to low carbon transport across the whole city. So we need to see far more political leadership, far more political bravery in terms of how to adapt to climate change. We sort of know what the answers are. It's a question of political will. So in terms of rain, about 17% of London is at risk of flooding, according to the GLA. A million Londoners live on floodplains. You might remember London is not new to thinking about flooding. Back in the day, we built the GLC built the Thames Barrier. And it's thanks to that extraordinary effort that London is relatively safe from flooding. But clearly, the climate change has got so bad now that even that extraordinary barrier is no longer enough. But we need a similar level of political will, similar levels of kind of huge investment projects. Maybe they don't look like barriers anymore. Maybe they look like sustainable urban drainage. So this is where you get rid of some of the kind of tarmac and the hard paving that is stopping water from being absorbed by the ground, and you put in more trees, you put in earth, you put in forests and flowers and plants, and that kind of soft squishy earth is then able to absorb all of these floodwaters as they pour down. the question of keeping London safe from flooding is not just about what we do in London. It's also about what we do upstream, up the Thames, up the Lea, up these kind of big rivers, up these valleys, so that the people living at the bottom of those valleys are kept safe from that extreme flooding. So it's a complex story is what I'm saying. There's lots of things that need to happen all across the board, massively cutting emissions, massively making kind of new projects. But we did it before. We built the Thames Barrier. It requires a similar level of political imagination and investment now to contend with the challenges ahead.
So next question, you mentioned earlier specifically that in architecture, this is the biggest concern, consideration that people should be working to. Some people are asking whether enough is being done within the architecture sector to address the very clear messages being conveyed by this IPCC report. What steps do you think need to be taken in reducing the staggering carbon footprint of architecture and city making?
I don't really think enough is being done. We're still seeing kind of some of the biggest, most famous, most influential architectural practices kind of hesitant about getting on board with the RIBA's climate challenge. I think it's been pointed out to the sector. The architecture is kind of absent in the run-up to COP26 and how our sector can be involved in setting those kind of big international agreements. So I think it would be very difficult to say that we're doing enough as a sector. But we do know what we need to do. So there is a lot of hope. Like, you know, this stuff is not rocket science. Business as usual construction emits about a ton of carbon dioxide per square meter, but that you can massively reduce that by using different materials. So more timber, more cork, more hemp, more straw, more of these sort of hyper low carbon materials, even carbon sequestering materials need to get specified so that we can bring down the embodied carbon of using highly processed materials like steel and concrete. We also know that the easiest and most efficient way to reduce the carbon impact of building new buildings is to not build new buildings. You know, reuse the existing buildings. I would support at this stage a ban on demolition. I think, you know, if you want to demolish something now, the standard should be so high that it's almost impossible. Local authorities stop giving planning permission for any demolitions, except in like extreme exceptional circumstances. I think that would be a very straightforward way to massively reduce carbon emissions. And a fascinating design challenge, right? The best, you know, I've studied architecture, and the best and most exciting projects are the ones where you have quite a lot of constraints, you know, lots of kind of tricky little challenges to negotiate. And one way of getting those constraints is to have to retain existing buildings.
You are listening to The Lundown, a weekly news show brought to you by Open City. We rely on support from people like you to make this show. So if you like The Lundown and want to support our work, please share the link, leave us a review on iTunes, and consider becoming an Open City friend. The Lundown is supported by Adobe, makers of software including Photoshop, InDesign and Audition, the program we use to edit this show. Go to open-city.org.uk/Adobe to sign up for a special discounted subscription to Adobe Creative Suite for as little as $9.99 a month, and Adobe will donate to Open City for everyone who signs up. Our next story today was reported across Twitter and in The Guardian. Latin Village, London's only surviving Latin market, has been saved from demolition after the developer pulls out. The indoor market, situated in Tottenham near Seven Sisters Tube Station, was marked for a multi-million pound residential plan by property developers Grainger. The scheme, devised in 2008 and approved in 2012, proposed the demolition of the historic Wards building and Seven Sisters indoor market in order to erect 190 build-to-rent flats with no affordable housing provision. Opponents of the scheme criticised it as a gentrification plan that would displace poorer, ethnically diverse communities from the area. 15 years of local opposition and campaigning, which saw the community members forming a human chain around the market, listed as an asset of community value, forced Grainger to abandon its development plans. In its place, Seven Sisters Development Trust, formed by local residents, businesses and market tenants, have proposed an alternative community plan for the site. So Finn, what's this all about? What's the point in protecting this indoor market from redevelopment?
I mean, this is a fantastic story. We have so many kind of doom and gloom stories on the Lundown, but this is a really kind of positive, exciting one. It's a story about a community group winning, or at least winning a battle in a long-term campaign. So, which, you know, feels very rare and precious against the kind of unstoppable tide of the wrecking ball. So what's going on here is you have a property developer who entered into a deal with the local authority to buy up this bit of street and turn it into a bunch of housing. But that wasn't a kind of, you know, neutral thing. This particular area is one of London's only kind of clusters of a Latin community, and includes the Seven Sisters Indoor Market, which you know, is this fascinating place, right? It's a sort of extraordinary, very kind of dense mix of lots of different traders, lots of different shops, all sharing this one indoor market. It's definitely worth visiting if you've never been. You know, indoor markets used to be a big part of kind of the British urban form, but have been increasingly pushed out or massively gentrified in places where land values are very high, like in London. And then this particular market is even more interesting because it has become this kind of nexus, this hub of the Latin community, who, I don't know, have been like actively targeted by the forces of gentrification recently, and just lost a very important community hub in the Elephant and Castle shopping centre, which is now, as we're talking, being demolished. And so this was one of the last remaining spaces that could be called a kind of centre of Latin culture in London. And that's why it is so exciting that after a 15-year campaign against this development proposal, it does seem like the developers have given up, the council's changed their mind, and potentially this community-led alternative plan will be the one that goes forward instead.
Can you shed some light on how they did it?
Well, hard bloody work is how they did it. So, I mean, this it is actually shocking, the effort that was required to defend this indoor market. So, you know, just some of the things that the community has done over the last 15 years. They established a trust, the West Green Road and Seven Sisters Development Trust. They established a community interest company, the Save Latin Village and Wards Corner Community Interest Company. They ran a legal defense fund. They submitted a alternative community plan, which they made a planning application for, which included over 500 documents submitted to the council. Many of those letters from local residents and businesses in support of the alternative plan. But then, of course, they also drew up like an enormous architectural proposal for the alternative plan and worked with local architects to develop those schemes. They were very effective campaigners. They got a lot of interest from journalists. You know, they even got the attention of the UN, right? So twice the UN issued statements in support of the indoor market and the Latin village. So an astonishing amount of work and effort from the community there and their supporters, which maybe tells us that it really just how hard it is to sort of stem the tide of development, what a lot of effort goes into it, and why so many campaigns to prevent demolition or redevelopment are ultimately unsuccessful, because they just can't match this level of work that is required.
That's interesting, because that kind of holds Granger's quote into a different light, because Granger said one of the reasons for their withdrawal from the project was due to the numerous challenges implemented by a, quote, small yet vocal minority, What's your take on that? Was it a small minority, or is there a bigger movement at play here?
Yeah, I really love that the developers have called the UN part of a small minority. Obviously, it's not a small community. This is a huge deal. There's a lot of support for the Latin Village. Really, the reason Granger have backed out is because at some level, even if it's not in the press release, they must have realised that the movement to save the Latin Village is big and is only growing. But I do think there's a couple of like very interesting things that we can take from the UN's intervention. So they made two big interventions, one in 2017, one in 2019. And they say, and I'm going to quote them, we're concerned that according to reports, this treatment appears to be particularly targeted at people of Latin American origin and descent and includes language with racial discriminatory undertones. So they're talking about the way that this development has been targeted at this particular community. So I think that's interesting because it's showing that there is this direct link between these top-down regeneration projects, which are about sort of breaking up a working class community and bringing in, more affluent middle-class people. There's a link between that and discrimination based on race and other forms of prejudice. And the second thing I was struck by in the UN quote, I'm going to quote again, they say, "We urge the authorities to investigate and, where necessary, sanction such behaviour to protect the affected people from abuse or infringement of their human rights." Who are those authorities, right? The UK's Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government dismissed the relevance of any possible disadvantages to the Latin community caused by the redevelopment. So they've got no allies in national government. The land is owned by Transport for London, who are in turn owned by the Greater London Authority, which is London's governing body. And in 2008, Haringey, the local authority, gave Granger planning permission to knock down the building on the corner of the site and in fact agreed to use a compulsory purchase order to take possession of the bits of the site that Granger had been unable to purchase for themselves, which was key in enabling the redevelopment project in the first place. So we have the local authority, the city authority, and the national government all, at one point or another, working alongside the property developers to kill the Latin Village and boot out its community. So I find it very weird that the UN is calling on the authorities to protect the Latin community, because it is precisely those authorities who are engaged in endangering the community in the first place.
Our next story was reported in City AM and is all to do with the government's push to get Londoners back into the office. Recent figures from the Centre of Cities think tank show that footfall in central London remains extremely low, at around 34% of pre-pandemic levels. Meanwhile, Rishi Sunak has renewed calls for young workers to go back to the office now that the government's work from home order has been dropped. The Chancellor, who was previously an investment banker in the city, recalled how his early career was helped by making relationships in the office with older colleagues. We reached out to London Property Alliance, one of Open City's principal partners, for this story, and a spokesperson told us, quote, "It is not only vital for the economy of workers to return to their offices, but also for a whole host of other reasons, including mental health and supporting younger staff whose careers have been adversely impacted by the pandemic." The spokesperson continued, "People meeting and collaborating in workspaces boosts creativity and productivity and supports the local businesses ecosystem. Across central London, every 100 office workers help support 18 jobs in retail, hospitality and leisure." Meanwhile, Downing Street has repeated sentiments saying that it would leave employers and employees to decide whether or not to continue working remotely. Many financial institutions have since said they will continue to operate under a hybrid model, allowing for employees to continue working from home several days a week. Finn, only some occupations are possible to be carried out remotely. The service industries, hospitality, teaching, healthcare, to name a few, cannot be carried out via Zoom. Do you think this disparity between in-person jobs and home working industries could lead to some sort of health gap of some kind? Or what's your comment on that?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And I think there's loads of workers who have never had the opportunity to work from home. And I do find it a little frustrating to see certain professional sectors getting kind of very irate about their bosses asking them to work more from the office, while still kind of doing nothing to appreciate and support other workers who have no choice but to work outside of their home. So, you know, a very simple thing we should all be doing is just like tipping Deliveroo drivers, which almost nobody does, but does, you know, it means something to those people and makes a difference. So I guess my advice is, you know, if you are someone who's a bit stuck working from home, you know, probably try and get back out in the world somehow, explore it, gently reconnect with colleagues, maybe once a week or something like that. But do it in a way that makes sense for you and is enjoyable, rather than the gammon on TV sort of lecturing you or hectoring you. But however you manage that transition, please, come on, let's start appreciating all those workers who can't work from home. Because ultimately, if you are able to stay at home all day, that is because someone else hasn't. Someone else has gone to the power station to run it to give you electricity. Someone has repaired the mobile phone mast that gives you phone signals. Someone is bringing you food. Someone is bringing you stuff. So all of us who are lucky enough to be able to work from home depend on an entire constellation of others who are not. And I think we do need to sort of appreciate that a little bit more in this debate.
Our fourth story this week was covered by the AJ and is all to do with the Greenwich Observatory revamp. The National Maritime Museum has announced a £4.5 million revamp of the landmark Royal Observatory, for which it is seeking an architect for an estimated £450,000 contract. The selected team will oversee an ambitious upgrade of the Grade 1, Grade 2 and Grade 2 star listed buildings, which make up the historic astronomical and navigational complex. The project aims to improve visitor facilities and create a new extension to the world-famous attraction, which is a scheduled monument located within the Grade 1 listed Greenwich Park and Maritime Greenwich UNESCO World Heritage Site. The latest project, combining master planning, site improvements and new galleries, coincides with the Greenwich Royal Observatory's 350th anniversary in 2025. The site is believed to be the oldest public park in the country, formerly Henry VIII's hunting ground. It was re-landscaped by André Le Nôtre during the 17th century and opened to the public in the 1700s. Finn, can you paint a picture of the historical importance of the Greenwich Observatory and why this is such an important and significant revamp for London's cultural map?
Sure. I mean, yeah, like Grade 1, Grade 2 and Grade 2 star list. It's got all the listings. That sort of gives you a sense of how much kind of special stuff is going on in this place. Okay, so Charles II commissioned this Royal Observatory, you know, 350 years ago. Christopher Wren picks the site. And for hundreds of years, it's this kind of centre of astronomical observation and measurement. But it also is playing the civic role. It's also kind of inviting the public to come up into this royal park. And it plays a kind of cultural role as well as a scientific one. And it's just got this kind of amazing collection of quite bizarre Georgian and Victorian buildings, because they're all trying to do two things at once. They're all trying to be a kind of civic building, but also be a kind of scientific device. So a lot of them have huge telescopes on their roof. One marks the prime meridian line. Another has this enormous red ball, which is a time ball, which is a kind of pre-public clock, time-marking device that goes up and down this pole to mark noon every day. And then, of course, it's looking down a hill at Inigo Jones's Queen's House, beyond that, Wren and Hawksmoor's Old Royal Naval College, and beyond that, the entire skyline of London. So it is an astonishingly potent context, and quite an intimidating one to try and design for. I think it was interesting in 2006, which was kind of the last time they did a big new architectural project there. It was a planetarium. It was designed by Allies and Morrison. I think it's one of their best projects. It's this kind of black patinated cone, and a really good contribution to that site. It doesn't try to kind of compete with or outshow the wacky scientific kit. You know, I don't envy the architects who are going to win this, because it's going to be a seriously difficult job.
Finn, for you, what are some successful and less successful examples of upgrades to historic buildings in London? What can we learn from previous projects?
There's a golden thread running throughout this show, which is about not knocking things down and doing like really good refurbishments instead. So a couple of kind of standout examples, Somerset House. You know, this sort of, I think it was finished in 1801, largely housed civil servants for a very long time. And they used the main courtyard of Somerset House as a car park. And then finally, with the turn of the millennium, they got some money from the new government, kick out all the cars, kick out the inland revenue. And Donald Insull Associates transforms this car park into a public square. And it's now one of the most successful public squares of its kind. I think it was where Es Devlin did that big installation when she planted a kind of cluster of trees in the summer as part of the London Design Festival. So it's become a kind of centre of culture, a centre of design, and an enormously successful public space. And then perhaps one of the best upgrades that, you know, Howarth Tompkins at the Battersea Art Centre, a very long-running collaboration between the Art Centre and this particular architect, making lots of significant adjustments all over the complex, but also after that disastrous fire that gutted the main hall of Battersea Art Centre, Howarth Tompkins kind of remade that auditorium, put in a new roof and new seating. And now it's a world-class arts venue. Well, I think it is anyway. And that's an upgrade project. That wasn't built from scratch. That was a refurbishment.
Finally, Open City has launched its full programme of events and venues for this year's Open House Festival. The festival, which celebrates London's remarkable architecture and urban landscape, will run from Saturday the 4th of September to Sunday the 12th of September, with hundreds of events and tours taking place across all 33 London boroughs. Landmark buildings opening for free to the public will include City Hall, 10 Downing Street, Trellick Tower, Millennium Mills, 1 Canada Square and Trinity House. Visitors can expect to see buildings, landscapes, infrastructure and community projects from across the capital open up to the public for the first time since the start of the pandemic, alongside a citywide cultural programme for all ages and abilities, including numerous outdoor events. This year's Open House Festival will include a particular focus on London's pubs and breweries, which have suffered during the pandemic, with a publication of a new book, Public House, A Cultural and Social History of the London Pub, celebrating over 120 remarkable pubs across all 33 boroughs. Finn, can you tell listeners a bit more about what they can look forward to in the festival this year?
I would be delighted. There are so many amazing things. I was looking through the programme, which is live now, listeners. It went live yesterday. It's live now. You can book for most things. There might be a few more things coming in, but essentially the program is up. It's all at openhouselondon.org.uk/2021. And there's so many cool things to go to. I have to confess, I work for Open City. I was a little bit worried that there'd be so many buildings who you know, just couldn't open up this year. And I am absolutely thrilled that that's not the case. There's so many buildings, so many people have made it work. Londoners have figured it out. It's a bumper year for walking tours. I think walking tours are having a kind of like renaissance. So I think there's over 100 walking tours. But there's also lots of kind of traditional open house stuff to go and see. It's amazing that Downing Street's back in the mix, but also City Hall, but also the Guildhall. So we have three centres of government, national government, city government and borough government, all kind of opening up for public visits.
Fab, any personal highlights or favourite events and buildings taking place for you?
I am going to definitely go to Walter's Way. This is this self-built housing scheme in Lewisham. Bunch of council tenants in the 80s were given the opportunity to build their own homes in collaboration with the German architect Walter Siegel, and they did an extraordinary job. You know, all the houses are a bit different, but they've over time they've kind of fostered a really strong sense of community, and They usually put on quite a show for the Open House Festival, so it's fab that they're back in the mix, and they are doing a book launch. They've written a book about that street, about what it's like living on the street and what it was like building the street with Walter. And that will be that book launch is happening as part of the festival. Beckentry Estate. This is an extraordinary place, one of the largest estates in the world when it was built. 1921 was when the first houses were completed, so this is its 100th anniversary. It's a local London County Council scheme, 27,000 homes, enormous, underappreciated in my view. It was kind of the part of the post-World War One Homes for Heroes scheme, where the government kind of recognized that so many people had sacrificed so much during this horrible war, and then were returning to kind of basically slum conditions if they survived the war. And so this was part of an enormous investment to kind of upgrade the housing stock of the nation after World War One. And as part of the Open House Festival this year, the artist Verity Jane Keefe is leading a walk across the estate as part of a project she's doing there called Living Together, that's part of this kind of centenary celebration. I think, you know, she's a brilliant artist. It's a fascinating place. I think that's definitely worth getting on if you can get a ticket.
Nice. And Finn, why are pubs being spotlighted in this year's festival?
Pubs have had a rotten pandemic. They've been knocked around by lots of changing regulations. And so we decided to make a book celebrating London's pubs. It's called Public House, A Cultural and Social History of the London Pub, and it's edited by David Knight and Christina Montero. I think it's an amazing book. It features all sorts of different writers, some brewers, some architects, some historians, politicians, each writing about pubs in London in different ways. So over 120 pubs kind of discussed in the book. And I guess what we're really trying to do is tell the story of London through its pubs and kind of make the argument that London's pubs are not just, you know, the hospitality sector. They're not just kind of businesses that trade, but they are civic places. They are cultural places. They play a role as community centres to some extent. They are inseparable from the kind of cultural life of London, and that they should be celebrated in that spirit. I think there's been a lot of discussion in the media about pubs are great because they're good employers or they're like nice to go to, but they also play this they are a kind of social glue as well, or they can be at their best, and so that's a kind of we're trying to use the book but also the festival itself to really kind of spotlight pubs and celebrate that role that they play in London's wider cultural life.
That sounds great, Finn. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about how they access the festival, how they navigate it, everything like that?
There's one website. It is openhouselondon.org.uk/2021. From there, you can access the programme. You can access all the kind of links. You can even, if you want to be part of the programme, there's still some time for some last minute inclusions. So if you want to get your flat in the show or get a building you've designed in the show, there's still time. So openhouselondon.org.uk/2021, and I will see you there.
Great. Thank you so much for being our special guest this week, Finn.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Lundown, a show from Open City, rounding up the big stories in architecture and the built environment each week in London. If you've enjoyed the show and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which has covered all these issues and many more too. You can find the show on Twitter or Instagram at @OpenCityLondon, or by using the hashtag Lundown, LNDDWN. Open City receives no public funding, so if you want to support our work, please go to open-city.org.uk/support and sign up as an Open City friend. Open City is dedicated to making London a more open, accessible, and equitable city.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.